for being here, and we are always glad that you want to spend some of your time with us. If you're new to the program, please go to redicecreations.com and also take a look at redicemembers.com for much more of what we do. Today we're going to continue a conversation that we began with Freighter X about a month ago now. We are going to switch topic, however, from Freemasonry that we talked about last time over to what he calls the secret war on human consciousness. Welcome back again, Freighter X. Thanks for coming on again so soon so we can continue our conversation, proceed where we intended to go for the second hour last time you were with us, but we didn't simply have the time for it that time, so we'll arrange it in this way again instead. So thank you for coming on, Freighter.
Well, definitely, Henrik. Thank you so much for having me back so soon as well. I really was anxious to kind of continue and complete the conversation, really. I guess we needed a four-hour format instead of a two, but I want to say that the show that we had, I really got a lot of positive response from a lot of people. I saw thousands upon thousands of more hits on my website than normal, and there was, you know, I've been invited onto about a half a dozen other shows now, and had several people, I would say 10 people took the time to write me extensive responses and feedback to the show. So it was really a good experience for me.
Very good. That's excellent. It's glad to hear that people are engaged and out there and listening, and of course, taking in the work and contemplating about it and going onward from there. Now, let me ask you a little bit about Freemasonry in connection to the subject that we're going to talk about today. We can kind of bridge it in that way, I guess. This topic of the secret war on human consciousness, is this something that you've, you know, worked on all, you know, in the meantime as you were getting interested in the esoteric and joining some of the orders that we talked about last time, or was this something that came to you later on?
Well, you know, it's sort of a combination of both. I mean, I feel like the whole thing was like a classic voyage of discovery for me. My own unpacking or just processing of my experience with the education system, which we touched on last time, and a need to kind of sort of understand how and why things were happening the way they were in our society and in my individual awareness. And so that was the journey at the beginning, but absolutely later on, the realizations that came after my own experiences involved in fraternal orders system, lodge systems, and the social aspects of it, as well as the political and ideological struggles within, I saw. And this is what I mentioned in our last show. I saw the microcosmic and macrocosmic sort of dichotomy between the mini theme of the secret war inside Freemasonry, basically esoteric versus material, you know, like materialism versus physical versus metaphysical, you know. And then on the big overarching theme was the secret war on human consciousness, that I realized that the metaphor was there. And that, so it kind of went hand in hand with my own experiences, my own individual development and education, and then the uncovering of what I saw as a struggle ideological within the system.
So describe to us a little bit what you mean with the secret war on human consciousness.
Well, I mean, I think that it's basically an information war of perception. And we can draw upon anything going on in current events, you know, with the current situation going on in Syria right now, for example. I mean, we're looking at a situation that's been the far-reaching program of our CIA and in America and the American government, United States government. I mean, for 59 years, they've been working on places like Iran, basically toppling the regime back in, not 59 years, 60 years, since 59 or whatever around that time. You know, they toppled the regime and begin basically violation of human rights there that have continued to this day, but we're focusing on Syria's government's violation of human rights on its people as they're the villain. You know, we can go and we can bomb indiscriminately with our smart bombs and drone attacks and kill civilians in Afghanistan or Pakistan or anywhere else, and that's all in the name of freedom. But you know, these other countries become, you know, and this is all about perception. I mean, we're the United States government. Our president stands up and says that, you know, and the State Department, you know, we have Mr. John Kerry standing up and saying that we're talking about using the threat of violence to coerce another nation in the United Nations. And that is in itself an illegal act. It is literally against the United States or the United Nations Charter for one nation to threaten another nation with violence for any kind of coercion. I mean, there's a reason why we did that. You just got to look back through history. Look at Hitler. You know, he used the threat of violence to invade Czechoslovakia. Look at Russia's control of Eastern Europe for all that time. How did they control Eastern Europe? With threat of violence and with actual violence against the Eastern European countries. I mean, that's the threat of violence that's supposedly banned by international law. But the United States government is immune to this somehow. We can stand up and say that, and that's not an illegal act. But and then of course we all know that the chemical weapons and all the other weapons those countries and factions are using against each other, we're involved in supplying those weapons. So it's all about perception, you know. So this is drawing it from the present, going backwards. I see this as a far-reaching plan, Henrik, that probably began 10 to 12,000 years ago.
That far,
in the wake of whatever earth-shattering, earthquaking cataclysm occurred that we have these remnant recordings of, the flood myths and all the other cataclysm stories you find in all the cultures around the world, which I've pretty much mapped out my own bibliography, working with cross-referencing from so many different writers, researchers, and media providers that you, of course, have had many on your show. And a lot of these people would offer their own cross-reference. I mean, there's a mountain of data that all point to the fact that humanity went through some sort of almost completely catastrophic, if not completely catastrophic, event or series of events, which I believe knocked the whole of humanity as a species offline, collectively. Consciousness, it's like a post-traumatic stress disorder, species-wide.
Yeah.
And in the wake of that, I believe a small faction of whether they were human, hybrid human, or extraterrestrial, or whatever, I can't say that, but I have my suspicions. But some either inner or outer species predator saw an opportunity, seized upon the moment, and basically usurped human consciousness and took us down the road which leads to today. And so my article, which I wrote for Paranoia Magazine, was just the culmination of the research that I was gathering from doing my 3 years of broadcasting on my own radio show, as well as research for the book that I'm working on, The Secret War Inside Freemasonry. And so I looked at it from a very focused Americanized view, because to be honest with you, I'm American. I've never even left America. I've been all over America. I hitchhiked and walked from sea, you know, coast to coast and up and down, but
right.
I've never left America. So I can only speak so, you know, scholarly or intellectually about outside of America, but I can speak experientially from within. And based on what we are taught in the history classes in school versus the other information that might be gathered from independent research.
Let me ask you, what do you think that this is based on? And this will be another philosophical thought, because we can't know. I don't think anyone of us can know. But the desire to control mankind, other humans, to control civilization, ultimately, as you described it, the perception, if you will, reality. If this goes back so far, someone obviously had a plan or conceptualized a plan at some stage to do this. But what do you think is the driving force here? If we're talking about human beings, I guess that's the closest. otherwise, it would be impossible for us to motivate or understand it, I think.
Well, I think there's always the practical driving force of the power that's wielded through controlling large populations of humans. The productive power, for example, the resource power. There's all that. But I think there's something deeper, an ideological power, a draw to the just the power in, for power's sake almost, you know, the domination concept that we find in predatory thinking. You know, I think it really is a psychological aspect almost. You know, I think there's something to that. That's to me, you know, I mean, but what we see is when you just mentioned looking back through history, we see over and over again that the power that rises to the top, the state control or the city state or the nation state or however it manifests, they always are doing the same thing. They're looking backwards at the power structure before, drawing from the ancient records, drawing from the histories, drawing from the philosophies and the approaches, reformatting it, repackaging it, and then representing it to the people or the populace for consumption and control. And it just keeps yeah, it just keeps getting refined over and over again down through the millennia. And then, you know, Joseph Atwell wrote that book, Caesar's Messiah. I know you've spoken with him as well. He was just on recently with another researcher. And, you know, he hits it right on the head, the idea that religion is a tool of mind control. It's something that you see recurring, and it gets really focused in the European histories, especially in the colonial history, you know, from England, Spain, France,
yep.
You know, these countries all reaching out and colonizing other nations. And you see, when you look back through, like, English history, Henry VIII, the Reformation, all this stuff, these people understood King James, the King James Bible. They understood, they were students of ancient history. And as the, you know, Renaissance opened up the knowledge of the past, they realized that this is how you control populace, through faith, through religion, through a priesthood. You know, I mean, they already knew it. It was already in place. The papacy had already began the program long before then, but they were sort of re-realizing it, you know, rediscovering this
right.
fact.
Well, it's interesting. I think, you know, sometimes we see it as a response to the previous tyranny that's been in place. Live action plan of the Hegelian dialectic, if you will, in action. I think that, you know, because sometimes it seems like people are in a position where they've had enough of, you know, position A, so they're dying for position B, but all in the meantime, they're actually still, you know, stuck within the paradigm, still stuck within just two really bad choices. And it goes back to what you said earlier as well, that sometimes you have, or most times in history, you can realize when you look back at it that the tyrant in place, the dictator, what have you, has been put in place for this very reason, so that people will swing back, follow, you know, over to the other side, live there a couple of, you know, 50, maybe 100 years, and then swing back the other side. It seems like we're stuck in this pendulum activity. You know, we're not actually really getting out of this cycle, Frederick.
Oh, absolutely. And it's been identified, defined, and redefined, just like you said. It's this pendulum swinging back and forth between reaction and action, reaction and action. And it's a great way, a self-preserving method for the status quo, you know, that keeps them in control, like you said, because they're always responding to the former administration or the former leader or the former head, but we're still trapped within the paradigm. We're stuck within the same paradigm. So it doesn't matter. We can go all day long debating back and forth as long as we're within this playing field. And if you look around anything ideological in human society, you find that form of control. And that's part of the secret war on human consciousness and the secret war within Freemasonry as I identify it. Because what they do is they take real knowledge, real wisdom, real understanding, usurp it, and then replace it with counterfeit knowledge.
Yeah.
Counterfeit realization, counterfeit understanding, which creates that, you know, discordant view. You know, it's a method of neurolinguistic programming, really, because innately you know when you're being lied to and when you're lying. You sense the dishonesty, and so it creates, I think, it's a vulnerability. It's that anxiety that is used over and over again to manipulate us. So it's an inner friction that's generated from being presented with a falsehood that's been wrapped in some sort of mistruth and presented to you as truth. And you know you're receiving falsehood. You know it. But you can't, it's an intuitive sense. You know, like when you know somebody's pulling your leg, like a street magician, but you can't figure out how the trick yet is. You know you're being tricked, but you just don't know how. And so that's a good analogy, because it's all about misdirection of awareness. And the electronic age that we're in now is a perfect forum for that sort of exchange, because everyone's so distracted, and that's all it takes. Just follow the queen, the three-card Monty. Just keep being distracted. We're all distracted, you know. And so bringing it to the topic of this discussion, you know, the secret war, I believe, is being waged on human consciousness in the guise of, right now, the 21st century. It's that never-ending battlefront. I talk about this in my paper, the constant expanding militarization. And we're seeing that right now. I mean, Mr. Anti-War President, President Obama, came in on the ticket of ending the war in Iraq and closing Guantanamo Bay. And now we're going to war with Syria. I mean, yeah, they've taken it off the, you know, DEFCON 4 or whatever they call it, you know, to, like, you know, we're not going to launch the Patriot missiles that we've, like, basically surrounded the nation with yet. But you know, we're going to, you know, all options are on the table. They be sure to keep reminding us of that. And we all know it's a chess move with the Putin, you know, Putin's on one side trying to play his hand out and at the same time earning brownie points with the United States State Department for whatever negotiating power that may provide him with later. And whatever happens, even if it all falls apart, it works for all their benefit because they can just say, see, we tried the diplomatic solution and it didn't work. Now launch those Patriot missiles. Let's get going, boys. I mean, that's the next step. And meanwhile, it's okay for Israel to stockpile weapons of mass destruction till the sun comes down, you know, but that's completely okay with our government. You know, that's not at all. And the fact is, the Golan Heights, does everybody realize that that's Syria, that Israel is currently occupying a part of Syria? That's okay, though, somehow.
Well, but, you know, yeah, there's a lot behind that.
Sure, and it's part of this whole struggle, this whole war on human consciousness, because there's a battle on the temporal and the spiritual plane going on there, right, with Armageddon and the last, you know, the last stand of good and evil and the Zoroastrian struggle and all this, Uhura Mazda and Ahriman. It's all this big contrivance, right, because they were still inside that 10 to 12,000-year framework. If we look at Zarathustra and the ancient Persians, we see that that's where the rise of, I believe, what I have drawn from my research and other writers like John Lash, who, you know, he doesn't take exactly the same tact or interpretation of the data that I do. We stand, you know, and diverge in different ways. But what I recognize from the research I've gathered from his work and others is that these two camps arose in the, you know, around the ancient Iran. It was the Illuminators and the Illuminati. But before we get into them, let's bring the focus back to the United States, because that's where the article that I wrote really comes out of. It's the origins of this war on consciousness in the United States is so easy to identify and track if one just simply looks at the military history of America. Right after the Revolution, right after the War of 1812, and going through the Monroe Doctrine, which basically said to the world, hey, you know what? This hemisphere is ours. We're top dog. Even though we couldn't back those words yet in 1830 or whatever, we were on our way. You know, I mean, we were working towards becoming a world power at that point. And then it all was fully realized. You know, we saw the United States full-blown military-industrial complex coming during the American Indian Wars, and especially during the Civil War, all in the 19th century. And that's where I take the article for the folks who read the article is that journey through the United States military history, where we see, you know, first of all, I open it with the annexation of Texas, the idea that the United States decided to invade this ancient nation state of Mexico, literally that had been there for thousands of years before America, really, I mean, if you want to be serious about it. And the actual size, if you look on maps before 1844, if you just go to Google Image and type in map of Mexico before 1844, you do that, you will see a giant territory of land that goes from the southern border of Oregon to the eastern border of Colorado, the Kansas-Colorado line, and then all the way down to Central America. I mean, it's like the entire western half of the United States almost was Mexico. You know, people don't realize that. They don't realize, like, when the Mormons left Nauvoo, Illinois, running away from after Joseph Smith was killed by the mob. The Mormons went to Salt Lake City, right, Nevada. That was Indian territory. They literally left the continental United States when they went there. Mm. Outside, people got to think about the perception of that. Half of the United States was a foreign nation at this time, you know, in the early 19th century. And so we decide we're going to invade the nation that occupies that territory and take it, you know, by force. And we did slowly but surely, we just took that whole area over. So that's an idea of perception. When people think about illegal aliens and the whole big debate that goes on in America back and forth, and these people who judge Mexicans and other nationalities for crossing these imaginary border lines that have been drawn on the maps. When these people and their people have been walking this land for thousands of years, how dare anybody draw a line and say you're now illegal if you cross it? I mean, that's part of control and perception. But so basically, the United States, we moved in, we took over, and how did we do it? With a false flag event. We told the, you know, we basically said, hey, the Mexican government attacked us. even though we've sent in probably, my imagination says it was probably like a SEAL Team 6, like little 19th century SEAL Team 6 that went in and started some kind of problem and got the Mexican army all pissed off, and then they attacked them, and they're like, okay, we got a headline, boys, running in the paper tomorrow, you know, and
That seems to be it's a tremendously common thing, of course, of who begins the aggression, and I think in history, if we look back, there's been back and forth proof and claims of which makes it almost impossible to see. I've heard same thing in reverse in terms of Germany, that it was actually a Polish army that was aggressive against the Germans, and that's the reason they walked in. You see what I mean? This has been like back and forth forever, and it's really difficult to know who began the aggression process, is it not?
Yeah, was there like a little global power elite handbook that they were handing out? Or something? I just don't know. It's like all right. A recipe. It's all a formula. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You see it over and over again, just like you're talking about. And so we move forward a little bit, and again we saw, well, I mean, the Civil War, 1861 to 1864 in America, furthered the industrialization, militarization, and basic social engineering program for this nation like nothing else. I mean, that's my contention. That's John Taylor Gatto's contention. That's so many other writers will agree that this was a huge thing, because it wasn't just necessarily just about the actual battlefront or the so-called issue of slavery, which, I mean, I'm not trying to downplay slavery at all, but it's so not what we've been presented with as far as the reasons for this. Frankly, just the fact that people don't realize, okay, the South grew cotton, right, and tobacco, right? Where do you think they sold that stuff?
Of course.
I think it went to the North, and then it was distributed to the rest of the world. And what was in the North? Oh, yeah, textile mills. You know, textile, like garments, which is made out of what? Cotton. Basically, they were working together. The North and the South were business partners.
That's
you know?
Right.
So, The whole move, that people don't realize that what was really going on there was, it was about slavery, yes, but it wasn't about African slavery. It was about the enslavement of the United States populace. And it was about they realized that the slavery paradigm was not cost effective anymore. The North told the South, hey, you know what? You're producing these slaves, and then you got to take care of them their whole lives. You got to feed them and clothe them and keep them on the plantation, blah, blah. You don't have to do that. Just cut these people loose and let them just, you know, struggle on their own out in the woods, and whoever survives will enslave them. And then, you know, we don't owe them anything. We don't have to take care of them. Let them just struggle on their own. And if they die off, all the better. They're producing like rabbits anyways. It's just fine. You know, that was the format that the North wanted to see, which they basically got. I mean, America now is this place where, you're punished if you need anything. You're punished if you need services. You're now going to be exposed to a whole new form of psychological coercion. But I'm digressing. The bottom line is that once again, that was the need. The need was to change the dynamic of production in America, and it's gone through several changes since then. But moving a little bit forward after the Civil War. Okay,
let me ask you this before we go there, and keep hold that thought in your head, and you move on the Civil War here, but. If we back up a little bit, we can see, obviously, that this is nothing new, as you've described before. I mean, Rome did this. The National Socialists in Germany did this. There's been waves of, you know, the Visigoths previously, the Vandals, the Huns, the Mongols. You know, it's like this has been this has been human history in essence. Tribal fighting, basically, over territory. What happens later in the process when, you know, you have nations coming together and industrialism adding on to it, that's when it becomes really brutal, and then something really different enters into it, of this mass extermination, you know, that we can see with the bombs and everything else. But if we back up to it again, we realize that this is like how human beings have lived for probably thousands and thousands of years, and of course it's violent, but at the same time it's in a certain extent has been it has been confined to some of the rules that we've seen in nature. So the question I've always asked, and you know, I love your take on this as well, Frater, is this an unnatural, you know, way about it? If we can see the same kind of, you know, territorial conquest in nature, if you will, or is there something else that has been at the root of why we come together in groups and try to, you know, defend our little tribe or what have you? What's your take on that?
Wow, that's the you never cease to ask the big hard question, do you, Henrik?
Sorry about that.
There, that's the one I mull over a lot. I mean, isn't it an organic issue? Is it natural or unnatural the way that humanity seems to manifest its organizational, you know, behaviors and the way that we struggle, as you say, with territory and resources? We all know that's the struggle. Look at every conflict in the world right now. And every major war zone in the world right now is filled with awesome resources that we love and want. I mean, every one of them, they're like plush, just like ripe fruit waiting to be picked. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
of course,
that's right.
In the minds of our industrialists. But there's all these, you know, there's a problem, right? There's all these people in the way. You got to get all these people out of the way so we can get to those resources. That's exactly where we can pick right back up in the conversation, because that's what happened in the wake of the Civil War. Let's think about it for a second, okay? The Civil War was fought between the North and the South. Now, the South, being the cotton nation and tobacco nation that they were, they used these things called riverboats, which was like a big, giant cake floating on a river, like a stacked cake, you know? And it was very flat-bottom, kind of top-heavy, light barge that would travel in shallow rivers up and downstream, transporting cotton and tobacco, which isn't very dense. It's big, but it's not dense. So these riverboats were awesome for doing that. But they weren't so great for transporting troops and guns and horses. They'd flip over and sink to the bottom of the river. So that was a decidedly disadvantage tactically for the South, whereas the North had railroads. Every major battle fought in the Civil War was fought within 10 to 20 miles of a railroad stop. So that's a fact. Look it up. I mean, it's been researched clearly that the North pretty much won the war with the railroads. And so at the end of the war, naturally, the railroad barons, those who owned the railroads and ran the railroads, had a really powerful position in this newly forming military-industrial complex. And so the election of 1876 came around. And in that election, there was two candidates. And maybe you've heard of this. It's something to consider when we think about the American political process. And there was two candidates. The Democratic candidate was Samuel Tilden of Rochester, New York. And he supposedly he won both the popular electoral votes for the election. Yet he was not made president. And the way that went down was there was 20 or so electoral votes that were in question. They used a technicality, basically, to question the vote, you know, bring it into legislation. I think it went to the Supreme Court's the method how it's decided. But they basically came up with a compromise, the great compromise of 1877. And the Republican candidate was a man named Rutherford B. Hayes. Everybody knows him in America because he was the president. He was made president. He was a Civil War general, too, who was real good friends with the railroad barons. And he's a Republican. The Great Compromise of 1877 basically let everybody know that here's what's going to happen. The Democrats will give the White House to Hayes and his railroad baron backers in exchange for the Republicans' release of their hostage, which was the entire South in the wake of the Civil War. The prisoner of war was the South, that they had federal troops, you know, on the ground in the South for the so-called Reconstruction, the social engineering program. I basically see that as it was a small model version of a social engineering program that they then ramped up to the entire nation. But they played it like, oh, we're taking the troops out of the South and we're ending the Reconstruction and everything's fine now. But what they really were doing was bringing it online for the whole nation. Schooling had already gone into effect. You know, in the mid-1800s, we had the first compulsion schooling laws, which basically forced people to send their kids to school. And, you know, the interesting thing is, John Taylor Gatto talks about this in his Underground History of American Education. If you look in the histories of the early days of compulsion schooling laws, you see that the law goes into effect in a little town, and everybody's getting forced to send their kids to school. And then, like, within a year or two of it, the whole town comes together and burns down the school and tar and feathers the teacher. And it happens over and over again, like, across America.
Yeah.
Because they were really, you know, the people, those the first wave of people being exposed to this draconian usury or compulsion schooling system understood what was happening.
Well, exactly. They had a perception of that time that whatever is happening to the kids, like they're being changed and they're being, you know, formed by a different entity than, you know, of course the parents, but even the community in that sense. And a completely foreign thing comes in there. And I mean, I remember we had the same thing in Sweden. Obviously, we had after the Second World War specifically is when the system really goes through like a massive reformation. I don't want to take you off topic here, but it was an interesting phase where they even worked really hard at removing all the dialects because the elite, you know, teachers or whatnot that were educated from a central point of view up in, you know, Stockholm in Sweden, they couldn't even understand the kids to the schools that they were brought to because their dialects were so strong, you know. So they have to reformulate the whole language and basically weed all the different dialects out of them. So it's all about homogenization. But go back again to your time there. What happened? They tossed out the teachers and everything else?
Yeah, well, that's just an example of the kind of social climate that was in America in the early days before, during, and after the Civil War and into the 19th century, what I call the Indian Wars, you know, the wars against the native tribal peoples. And it's talking about the same thing you're talking about. It's a different version of the same exact, we got to wipe out all indigenous footprint, you know, cultural indigenous footprint has to be wiped out and has to be homogenized, like you said, has to be pasteurized, has to be industrialized, repackaged, and represented to the people, and then they can practice it in controlled scenarios, that we're limited controlled scenarios, that we can just make sure everything's like we want.
And the reason for that has to be able to predict where things are going to go. Obviously, control is an obvious one, but for this system that they have of organization, of resources, of everything else, where everything is strictly mathematically planned, you know, and even if nature doesn't, you know, fold to these parameters, and we have a lower yield in crops one year, that can set up the whole, you know, the whole apple cart, and we can't have that, right? So everything goes down to control to be able to keep a strict and rigid order to how things are being run, correct?
Right, and like you said, real-time adjustment, being able to make real-time adjustments in the wake of change you can't control. Like you said, crop failure. If something happens and we got crop failure, we got to be able to manipulate the populace quickly to have them, you know, divert their consumerism to something else that we do have for them to buy. We've got stocked in the, you know, the caves where we're trying to keep them from going rotten, you know, the subsidized food that we already have or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm just, you know, speculating. But basically, so getting back to the subject, when Hayes was given the White House, so what's the first thing that Rutherford B. Hayes does? If you look in the history books, the first thing he does is declare a war on all the Indians between, like, the East Coast and the West Coast. Just wipe them out. Let's clear that property, boys. We got some railroads to lay down.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happens. And, you know,
really what they're saying is that through the when the North conquers the South and they unified in this way, that's really what enables this expansion process to begin.
Yeah, and it sets the groundwork, the floor work of the scaffolding of the military-industrial complex completely around the idea of, well, you have your railroad baron industrialists, and then you have the federal government military structure that become partners.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's the partnership. So what's the first thing they got to do? Like you said before, we have to industrialize and commodify and homogenize everything. And so we see these programs taking effect in the 19th century. We see the domestic genocide of the cultures that were here, the tribal cultures. We see the quasi-Prussian-like schooling system going into effect with Horace Mann and the New England set. We see compulsion education legislation going into effect, all to consolidate that hive national consciousness, that consensus reality. We see literary standards and critical thinking degraded as this collective consensus is rooted in what? In obedience and nationalistic consumerism. That's what our American culture is. It's rooted in that. We're taught in school three things. I said it last time, I think. You know, show up on time. That's the big deal. Don't be tardy. Don't be late. That's a huge deal. I have four children. And being at school on time is a big deal, you know. It's like they make like a moral issue out of it. I mean, it's like a huge thing. Why is that? Why are they imprinting our children with that emotional, moral dilemma?
It's because when you're standing at the machine and you have to push that button, you know, your presence there is key to the timing of that you and everyone else is there on time, right?
Yeah, it's back to that predictability, right? Predictability of the schedule. You're scheduled to be working at a certain time.
Yep.
We expect you to be there doing that. And then the second thing is obey your keeper. Obey your manager, supervisor, teacher, coach, whatever. You obey that person. No insubordination. Do what you're told. Don't ask questions. Don't think outside the box. Do what you're told. And the third thing is, do some rote, meaningless thing until the bell rings. I mean, it's something that you really have no passion for. There's nothing in it for you at all until the bell rings, and then walk away. You know, that's it. That's the three things we learn in school. And then, of course, you know, it's reinforced in our postmodern electronic age with all this pervasive, persuasive civic mythology, and now it's like a new faith-based belief system, the quasi-religious patriotism that's become like a faith-based religious, you know, belief system in America. This patriotism and consumerism, it's unbelievable. It's a cult in itself. And Joseph Atwell talks a lot about the royal cults, you know, and the imperial cults.
Yeah.
And you mentioned earlier, it's, you know, the playbook can be found in Rome. Well, it's so found in Rome. And we are still in Rome as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, definitely.
It's the same. And I've heard you speak of it as well. And so, you know, quickly breezing through the next, you know, 100 years of United States military history, we see over and over again false flag events, from the sinking of the USS Maine, where U.S. sailors were drowned in a Havana harbor just to justify our entering the Spanish-American War in 1898 so that we could take the colonies that Spain had stolen fair and square from the Mesoamericans, right? So we needed to take those colonies for ourselves, right? We're the new kid on the block. And then moving forward to World War One, the Great War, right? We had the sinking of the Lusitania, same thing, false flag event. Why? Because they knew what was going to happen. The Imperial German Embassy sent out worldwide telegrams to everybody telling them, if you go into these waters, especially in support of the Allies like England and other people we're in battle with, we are going to sink you. And so what do? We load up Lusitania with civilians and arms, you know, like weapons, and then just push it right into U-boat waters.
What was they doing there anyway? Do you know?
I don't know, because I from what all the research I can find, that area was completely cordoned off as danger zone. Don't go there.
Yeah.
And so they went right there with civilians and weapons, sank the ship, and boom, we're in the World War One. The funny thing is that when I was in school, we never heard anything about this. What they focused on was the death of Ferdinand in Serbia.
Yeah, through the Black Hand, that secret society. And I think it was a Serbian, Princip was his name.
Yes, and that's what, you know, we were taught that's the focus of the conflict. That's what happened was this. And you know, again, that was brought back online later on for the genocidal campaign that America was immune from during the, you know, Yugoslavian and Bosnian war there with Clinton.
Yeah.
But it's interesting how we're immune from that, too, right? I mean, all the other NATO nations get tried in international war court, you know, for war crimes, but America's somehow immune from that.
whoever wins the war, right? Because, I mean, same thing, look at all the penalties and fines and charges and everything else that was put on the Germans, both after the First World War and the Second. If they would have won, we would have seen nothing of that. It would have been put on all the other nations, you know?
Absolutely, and that's it. The victor writes the histories, and they manufacture the religion.
Yeah, that's right.
That's
right.
So moving forward, Pearl Harbor, another perfect example. We don't even really need to go into it. All we can say is that the American government allowed 2,000 U.S. soldiers to be slaughtered in Oahu overnight, so that because 80% of the public opinion in the United States that wanted nothing to do with what they called their European war. We don't want anything to do with that European war. That's what everybody would say around America until Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
And then people couldn't join fast enough to go fight over there. All of a sudden we got songs about it. It's all, you know, a big deal. But so it goes forward from there. Vietnam, same thing. You know, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, we know that was faked. Then
A lot of boats. I wonder if they do it out by the water because it's more difficult for a majority of people to see what actually was happening or how it went down.
I think it's about naval intelligence. I think it's always been about naval intelligence. Naval intelligence has a special place in the intelligence world.
Oh, they do. Ooh. The maritime, you know, brotherhood. They've always been up there. Yeah, for sure.
And then I think that's probably the birth of our intelligence. Think about it. I mean, who is a better spy than a sailor? He's in all these ports. He's going on back in the day when there was only sailing as a method of travel. A great spy would be a sailor because he's constantly coming into new ports. He's getting new information, you know, and he's bringing the news. And he's also a courier. He can take information to different ports easily because he's traveling.
That's right.
So, I mean, the false flag events continue. The PR campaign in true wag the dog fashion, the first Gulf War. We were told in America that the Iraqi soldiers were throwing premature Kuwaiti babies on concrete floors, cold concrete floors, and leaving them to die. That's what we were told.
Remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That's totally made up. That was totally made up by a PR firm. You know, I can't remember the name of the company, but it's been revealed that that was complete propaganda. That never happened.
Mm.
And that's not, you know, we know that. That happens all the time. We're hearing all these outrageous claims being made right now by the government trying to justify their moves in the Middle East currently.
Well, it's exactly. And again, same thing there. You had the Syrian leader, Assad, talking about basically he's, you know, more or less talking about how someone else is behind and to blame for this, and they haven't done it. He set up same thing in Libya before they invaded there. You had their state secretary going on all these different channels. He were on, you know, Press TV, the Iranian news source, RT, obviously, and some of the other ones that actually managed to broadcast it. I think it was in France, too, some company there, or a media outlet there. But basically saying, like, we're not behind this. These are rebels. We're trying to just prevent them from basically, you know, taking over the whole country and destabilizing it. But, you know, it wouldn't be heard. It wouldn't be heard.
Right. And, you know, our government wants to make everybody feel bad right now about kids being gassed in Syria, which is a bad thing. I'm not saying it's not a bad thing. But, you know, they don't want to admit that, for example, in 2004, we used nuclear weapons in Fallujah, and that there are babies being born right now in Fallujah that are mutated.
Are you talking about the depleted uranium or actually radioactive?
That's right. Yeah, well, I call those are nuclear weapons as far as I'm concerned.
Definitely. I agree.
Those are just a different form of nuclear weapons being used on people in that place. Why? Because we're there. Why? Because of some lie and a bunch of BS. Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. Yet we attacked them. It's ridiculous. You know, we probably killed a million people there by now. Who knows? I mean, even if they're not dead yet because of the radiation and all the other destruction of the water and the air and everything. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And people are sitting there thinking, oh, you know, it's really bad. I've heard some reports that say that depleted uranium weapons that were used in Fallujah have raised the levels of radiation to Hiroshima level in Fallujah.
Mm-hmm.
Hiroshima. So we basically nuked another country.
Yeah, a slow nuke. It's a long-term nuke. Yeah.
A slow nuke, right. Mm-hmm. We've created our own little homegrown Chernobyl right there in Iraq. You know, and the fact of the matter is that that we're the anchor of global security that Obama talks about.
Oh, sure. Oh,
years.
Yeah. You
we are a rogue empire. That's what we are. This nation is a rogue empire that self-immunized. That's what Noam Chomsky said on Democracy Now! On September 11th, just past week. He said that the United States is self-immunized from prosecution in the international court. And I brought up that example of Yugoslavia versus NATO. The United States is completely immune from the charges of genocide leveled on the NATO states. But yet, we're allowed to go free from that and continue to threaten other nations with violence if they don't comply with us. Who are we to say what they should do is what I'm saying.
Definitely. Let me ask you this. Who do you think runs the show? I've heard various takes on this and the fact that, and I believe that that's true, that it's other powers behind the throne of America. They're basically like the fist of the New World Order. They're doing the physical hard labor, you know, and all these young men and women are drawn into the military because they can't pay their bills or they want to, you know, try to get rid of their college mortgage or there's simply not a job enough, you know, to go around. So they join the military and so they're beneficial. And, of course, in the meantime, all the other Americans are paying for this, you know, through their hard-earned taxes and everything else. But it's been speculated that ultimately, you know, the Brits, maybe even via the Israelis, ultimately this could go down to the Venetians or the Phoenicians, of actually this maritime empire that actually is behind and running and setting the dictates, you know, more directly than through Britain, who's actually in charge of the United States of their policy or Israel. What do you make of that? Who's behind this?
Yeah, I think it's traceable. You look at the works of Anthony Sutton or John Coleman or there's just so many writers. The guy who wrote Creature from Jekyll Island, Griffin.
That's right.
Yeah, even Tragedy and Hope. You know, by Carol Quigley, which you can get now. They've re-released that book. It's available for a very reasonable price now. But these books track it. They show you the charts. They show you that there's these bloodline families that are still like dynasty controlling the rest of us. It's a dynastic. It's all been layered though now. So you can't just like the hundreds of appendant orders of Freemasonry. You can't keep track of them. There's so many. But it's always about the individual and the lines that they cross. And what is the usual prescription for what is the usual method or the usual ability that he has? It's usually a connection from a family tie, you know, a bloodline connection.
Yeah.
Look at all the leaders of the world right now. They're all related. They're all related. You know, there's all these like related, you know, cousins, and they're all
sure.
And they're related to the past leaders too.
Yeah.
It's just, it's not a coincidence, right?
It can't be. It isn't.
And I can't give you any more specifics, the evidence of my own experiences, except to say that I see the patterns like everybody else. If you're a thinking person looking at the details, you see the patterns forming.
Well, exactly, because what I think is happening, Frater, ultimately, is that American national sentiments are being obviously used to, as I said, to kind of work as the police force of the world, the physical violence and everything else. But ultimately, kind of in the same manner that the situation in Iraq was exposed, despite, though, what's interesting is that not much have actually been done about it, but it's more or less, you know, known, mainstream. Everybody knows that, you know, there wasn't any weapons of mass destruction. You know, oops, we're sorry. You know, the UK and the US were pushing for this, kind of, they made a mistake, more or less. But as more and more of this comes out, and as more of this lie is exposed, which is absolutely necessary and have to be done, but in that process, I think that there's also going to be a blame and a demonization happening of the U.S. in that process. It's kind of already happening on the international scene, and I think that this is to move to ultimately destroy the nationalism of the U.S. to bring them in more to a global state, if you will, like the European Union. You have the North American Union. What do you make of that?
I absolutely agree, and you see that going on in our country, in the society at large, the depersonalization of a nationalistic identity, like you said. And I mean, I'm sort of torn there. I'm not sure what to think about all that, but I know that in the end, what they can really count on, what the powers that shouldn't be, as some friends of mine say,
mm-hmm.
can really count on, what they can count on is all of us reeling from anxiety and misdirection.
Yeah.
We're all reeling. We're all so caught up in our own worlds, and then the world as we perceive it at large, and in the common and great struggles and all these things, and they count on that. They count on us not going back. The average person not going back and following through on questions and looking at it again later on and seeing, you know, the result of time, you know, what really manifests. And John Lennon said, time wounds all heals. You know, and it's true. After a while, the truth kind of comes out. And the problem is in our society, we're so busily being re-distracted by the latest, newest bulletin and new, you know, update and breaking news, that we're distracted from those moments when the truth rises up in the past, and we don't pay attention. And then when somebody presents it to somebody else, there's all this immediate skepticism that forms, like, oh, yeah, where'd you read that? Where'd you hear that? From the internet, you know, from this, that. And it's like,
yeah.
No, but if you, you know, if it was something that was reinforced by your civic mythology, you'd have no problem believing this.
That's right.
But it's ideological. Now, I know we're coming up on the last part of this first hour, and I feel like we've wet your taste buds on this, people. If you want to, now we've talked about this, the manifestation of the war on human consciousness. And we've talked that we've identified these false flag events. And in the second hour, I'd like to go into what I think is the solution and the ideas of how what a prescription that I've found from several thinking minds on how do we get out of this? How do we unlock the key, the chains that bind us?
Yeah, definitely very good. Is there anything you have to add to take us kind of up to the present day in terms of the different versions of the Gulf Wars or everything? Obviously, we... You know, 9/11 is part of this, you know, everything that we've seen with the false flag attacks and everything. But anything to add to that before we take a short break here?
Well, that's perfect. What we can say is that, you know, on September 11th, 1991, George Herbert Walker Bush, the first Bush there, that's 10 years to the day before the World Trade Center bombing in New York City, you know, the planes hitting the buildings, he told us, that he announced, this is in the wake of the first Gulf War, that this would usher in a new world order. And I mean, it is so clearly announced it to the world right there. You can go on YouTube, you can type in the speech from September 11th, 1991 and listen to him speak. And that the words that he said have been sampled in bands like Ministry back in the day, used the samples, I'll never forget, for a song called NWO, you know, New World Order. And they just keep repeating his little sample of him saying New World Order. And this is art imitating life, you know. It's so spooky almost. But this is where it's at. We coming up to the present day, in the conflicts we're seeing right now in Syria and all the other nations that we're involved in. We've got boots on the ground in 150 out of 190 UN countries. The United States has boots on the ground, military personnel on the ground in 150 out of 190 nations in the UN.
Mm.
That's an empire. We are an empire. And so the question is, what do we do? How do we match or respond to this? What can the individual do? And I don't claim to have all the answers, but what I claim to is have some experience and insight, which I believe is helpful for others to understand what's happening and to find their answer within, because that's the bottom line. The last words of the Buddha were, doubt and find your own light. And I think that's wise words, because we all need, he wasn't saying follow my eight pathway and the Four Noble Truths. He said, doubt. And follow, and find your own light, which means don't follow anybody else's religion but your own, as far as I'm concerned.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. And like all empires, of course, they do crumble eventually, no matter how much they think at the top that they've actually, this time we're going to pull it off. We're going to be able to hold it. We're going to be able to keep it, you know, with pills and technology. This time it's going to work, you know.
Yeah, better living through chemistry, man. That's the way it is, right? Better living through chemistry. But
yeah.
One more thing, can I just say?
Oh, sure, go ahead.
Check out my website, middlechamberfx.wordpress.com. That's middlechamber, the letters fx.wordpress.com. And check out freemantv.com for all the new media coming out there. We're working on some great stuff, and I wanted to bring everybody's attention to that. That's Freeman TV with our good friend Freeman Fly and Jamie. We're collaborating on several really amazing media projects right now, so I wanted to keep everybody looking at freemantv.com.
Definitely, that's going to be great. We're going to have those linked up as well. Tell us about your books as well, Trader.
Well, right now I'm still working on Secret War Inside Freemasonry. I have one book that I was one of the authors of, the Sync Book Volume 2, which is from Sync Book Press, thesyncbook.com at Sync Book Press. But I'm working on the Secret War Inside Freemasonry, which will be released by them. At this point, it's looking like it's going to be a late winter release. And after that, I've got several other book ideas, and I'm actually talking to a couple of other people about collaborating on some amazing stuff. There's a talk of getting involved in an Illuminati-based mobile app game, like a role-playing game that's going to be I've been asked to be a creative consultant on some of the more esoteric aspects of that,
mm-hmm.
you know, help design the ritual and stuff like that. But there's some talk of that, and then there's a couple of other big media projects. I'm involved with some amazing filmmakers and musicians. We're working on this show called the Conspiracy Science Theater, which is going to be going with People's Voice Network, I guess, David Icke's new network in November. And it'll also be all available through freemantv.com. But so as far as my books go, like I said, this article that we're talking about today is going to be published in the winter issue of Paranoia Magazine, which paranoiamagazine.com, I believe, is the website. And they're on Facebook, too, Paranoia Magazine. And I've got about a half a dozen other books, ideas and pitches in the works. I mean, most of my ideas have been welcomely accepted, you know, for me to continue to work on it. It's just a matter of, I have four children and a wife, and you know, I'm a working class wage slave like the rest of the people out there, and so I'm just trying to find time to do all that.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Work, to take care of all the responsibilities and still to do the research, and I basically have taking a break from the radio live weekly broadcast for obvious reasons, just because of the time and focus. I can't do all of it at once. But in the future, I will be returning to some sort of a regular podcast or broadcast myself. So look forward to that. You know, it'll be in the probably next year.
All right. Well, keep your eye on the website for much more on that and the upcoming developments. We'll have that linked up as well. We'll proceed with more in a few minutes here, Freighter. So stay with us, and we'll be back for more.
You'll be 10 bears?
I am 10 bears.
I'm Josie Wales.
I have heard. You're the Grey Rider. You would not make peace with the Bluecoats. You may go in peace.
I reckon not. Got nowhere to go.
And you will die.
I came here to die with you. I'll live with you. It ain't so hard for men like you and me. It's living, it's hard.
And all you've ever cared about has been butchered or raped.
Governments don't live together. People live together. In governments, you don't always get a fair word or a fair fight. Well, I've come here to give you either one or get either one from you. I came here like this so you'll know my word of death is true. And that my word of life is then true. The bear lives here. The wolf, the antelope, the Comanche. And so will we. And we'll only hunt what we need to live on, same as the Comanche does. And every spring when the grass turns green and the Comanche moves north, you can rest there in peace. Butcher some of our cattle and jerk beef for the journey. The sign of the Comanche, that will be on our lodge. That's my word of life.
And your word of death?
It's here in my pistols, there in your rifles. I'm here for either one.
These things you say we will have, we already have.
That's true. I ain't promising you nothing extra. I'm just giving you life and you're giving me life. And I'm saying that men can live together without butchering one another.
It's said that governments are chiefed by the double tongues. There is iron in your words of death for all Comanche to see. And so there is iron in your words of life. No signed paper can hold the iron. It must come from men. The words of ten bearers carry the same iron of life and death. It is good that warriors such as we meet in the struggle of life or death. It shall be life.
We will continue, as we do with the second hour, at redicemembers.com. Go there to read more about our subscriptions. Sign up to get full access to all our programs, videos, films, commentaries, and much more. It's only about the price of 2 cups of coffee per month, and we have 3-month subscriptions up to 2 years available. And of course, as you invest in us, you'll ensure that we can continue to bring you our investigations, interviews, and insights. We can also expand into new territory and grow in the process. Support those whom you enjoy and appreciate, and I think the world would become a better place. We have some interesting programs for you lined up next with Anthony Peake, Neil Kramer, Chad Andringa, and then later we have Phil Stanford and Kingsley Dennis. All right, well, thanks for listening. We'll speak to you and Fredericks in Hour 2 next.